Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. The Middle East is a war zone. While Gaza may be ground zero, barely a day goes by when there isn't also fighting in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Iran, Israel, the Red Sea, and elsewhere. Moreover, for months, experts have been warning that these individual conflicts could infect each other, producing a much more dangerous big war that could pull in the U.S. and others. Today, I want to focus on Yemen, where for years, the Iranian-backed Shia Houthis have been fighting more or less successfully the Saudi and Emirati-backed Sunni government. Why does that matter to anyone outside Yemen? First, the Houthis are an integral part of Iran's coalition of militias across the region. Second, for months, the Houthis have been attacking ships going through the Red Sea, with an important consequence for international shipping. Third, a recent Houthi drone attack on Tel Aviv led Israel to launch a spectacular air assault on the Yemeni port of Hodeida. Arguably, that disproportionate violence was aimed not as much at Yemen or the Houthis as it was at Iran. My guest today can help us make sense of all this and perhaps to imagine how to get off an escalator that seems to be heading in the wrong direction. Allison Miner is an American Middle East expert currently at the Brookings Institution in Washington. She recently served as Deputy Special Envoy for Yemen at the U.S. State Department, which means I have to tell you up front that what she says today are her views and not those of the American government. Welcome, Allison, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thanks for having me on, Ellen.
Let's start with the Houthis themselves. Who are they and what do they want?
So the Houthis emerged as a religious revivalist movement in northern Yemen a few decades ago. Northern Yemen, where the Houthis are from, was a highly marginalized part of the country that the former ruler dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, had purposely sought to marginalize, to constrain developmentally, in part because of Yemen's history. So prior to the 1960s, northern Yemen was ruled by an imamate. And that imamate was led by a class in Yemen who believed themselves to be descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, this Sayyid class. And the Houthi family count themselves among this class. That imamate was overthrown in the 60s, and Yemen became a republic, which eventually was led for decades by former President Saleh. So Saleh always saw this Sayyid class and their heartland in northern Yemen as a threat to his legitimacy and sought to suppress them. So the revivalist movement that the Houthis grew out of was in part a response to this marginalization, but it also has deep religious and ideological foundations. So the Houthis and about a third of Yemen are a sect of Shia Islam. It is drastically different than the type of Shia Islam we see in places like Iran. Ideologically, it actually more closely resembles the religious beliefs of the dominant Sunni sect in Yemen. But the Houthis the founder of the Houthis used these religious beliefs to foment support among this revivalist movement. And this really gained steam after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. And we started to see closer collaboration between the Houthi movement and Iran. There was definitely, if not close religious alignment between these groups, instead a deep respect for.
I want to come back to Iran in some detail in a moment, but perhaps you can give us a sense of what the Houthis want both within Yemen and maybe outside Yemen.
So the Houthis' goal, first and foremost, in Yemen is to reassert control of the country. The Houthis control most of historic northern Yemen. You might know that Yemen used to be divided into two, northern Yemen and southern Yemen, up until the 90s. The Houthis control most of the north, which is where most of the population lives, around 25 million people of a total of roughly 30, 35 million in all of Yemen. But the Houthis don't have access to any of the country's oil and gas resources, which puts the Houthis in quite a precarious position. So the Houthis, first and foremost, want to cement their control over Yemen, but they also have deep religious or deep regional ambitions. If you listen to some of the Houthi ideology, they say that they want to liberate Mecca and Medina, of course, which exists inside of Saudi Arabia, but also Jerusalem. So I think while these might be highly aspirational goals for the Houthis, they certainly want to prove themselves as a major regional player, even as they continue to work on cementing their control of Yemen itself.
And they have been fighting what was then the government in Sana'a since early in the 21st century. And as you've just said, thus far have succeeded in controlling a fair amount of the population, but have fought both the Saudis and the Emiratis, who are on the other side of this battle, more or less to a standstill.
The Houthis seized the upheaval following Yemen's version of the Arab Spring in 2011, actually allying themselves with the former dictator of Yemen, who was overthrown as part of that Arab Spring process, to disrupt the transition process and seize control of the capital in 2014. As they began to assert their control and push the democratically elected president out of power, a Saudi-led coalition intervened to try to reinstate that government beginning in March 2015. That campaign, while it did push the Houthis out of some portions of southern Yemen, largely ground to a standstill as we approached 2020. And after persistent efforts from the UN, supported by the US and other members of the UN Security Council, the UN managed to negotiate a truce between the Houthis and other Yemeni parties, overseen by the internationally recognized government of Yemen in April of 2022. That truce significantly decreased fighting inside of Yemen. It also halted the major cross-border attacks that were occurring between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia and the UAE. During these, you know, several years of war, the Houthis had really honed their capabilities with both missiles and drones to conduct very sophisticated attacks. And we've seen that those capabilities at play since October 7th, both with the Houthi attacks on maritime shipping, but also, of course, on July 19th, the attack on Tel Aviv that killed one person and injured several others.
Both of which we need to talk about in some detail. But to set the frame of that, what is the Houthi relationship with Iran? As you said, they are at a very meta level, co-religionists, although dramatically different sects within Shia. And this is it's clearly much less about religion than it is about other kinds of support, interaction, and ambitions. How would you characterize their relationship to the Iranians?
Iran has definitely been absolutely essential to the growth of the Houthi movement, and particularly the growth of their external attack capabilities, their missile and drone capabilities. Much of what they use in these attacks is Iranian technology developed with Iranian expertise. And the partnership between the Houthis and Iran has grown. Iranian support for the group increased significantly after they began to demonstrate themselves as a really effective way to counter Iran's main rival in the region, Saudi Arabia. Religiously, we have seen some growing ties between the Houthis, while they do come from a sect of a branch of Shia Islam that is far different from the 12-verse Shia Islam of Iran. The Houthis have started to adopt beliefs and practices that more closely resemble those in Iran, which is noteworthy because Yemen previously did not kind of align to this same type of sectarian Sunni-Shia divide that other countries in the region did. And one of the consequences of the conflict inside Yemen over the past decade is that growing sectarian divide in the country and religious tensions between Sunni and Shia Muslims in the country. I do think it's important to note when we're talking about the Houthi and Iran relationship that the Houthis are not an Iranian proxy. The Houthis see themselves as a partner of Iran not as a proxy. And Iran does not really have the ability to fully dictate Houthi behavior. The Houthis have demonstrated that they will take actions, even when they are counter to Iranian interests, if they believe it is in their interest. We saw this most dramatically in 2019, after there's a major attack on Saudi oil facilities in Abqaiq that the Houthis eventually claimed credit for. Iran was attempting to use the Houthis at that time to stoke regional conflict with Saudi Arabia. Immediately following that attack, the Houthis actually proclaimed a unilateral ceasefire with the Saudis and attempted to move to negotiations at that point because they did not believe that, those regional tensions would be in their benefit at the time. So I think we need to remember that in this moment that the Houthis' ambitions are bigger than being an Iranian proxy. And particularly now, they've demonstrated that they are both a more aggressive actor than Iran and capable of taking greater risks than Iran is in this current moment. And I think as we see the Houthis continue to assert their independence and to build out networks, both within the Iranian axis of resistance, but also beyond, we've seen reports of Houthi cooperation with al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa, growing reports of Houthi cooperation with Russia. I think that we could see them really expanding out their capabilities, their support, their networks, and attempting to really play out these regional ambitions, leveraging their highly strategic geographic position.
Those are incredibly important points. In the last week, in conversations with various people in the Middle East, I keep on hearing the metaphor, the octopus metaphor. And it clearly is wrong. The octopus being the head of the octopus, Iran. They have all these tentacles, one of which is Yemen, which implies not just control, but complete ownership. And clearly, as you said, your view is that wildly exaggerates both the degree of control from Tehran, but also the degree of independence from Sana'a, from the Houthis. Let's focus on those two recent Houthi actions that you mentioned, the ongoing attack on ships in the Red Sea and the attack on Tel Aviv, both supposedly in solidarity with the Palestinians. But in an article you recently wrote in War on the Rocks, you said, quote, a more powerful motivation for Houthi attacks is the need to distract from growing domestic dissent over their governance and to bolster the Houthis' position both inside Yemen and within the region. Again, that is consistent with your view that they are operating on their own agenda, which happens to overlap with others. Is that fair?
I think that's true. I think the Houthi motivations for their attacks on Israel and their attacks on maritime shipping are really threefold. First is that attempt to combat Israel, to defend what they see as the Palestinian cause. Second, it is their relatively precarious domestic situation. Since April 2022, Yemen has been in a situation that many Yemenis call no peace, no war. So we are not seeing active fighting on the ground, but nor has there been a political process that actually brings some degree of political and economic stability to the country. Because the Houthis do not control access to any of Yemen's oil and gas resources, their revenues are actually quite limited. A few years ago, the UN estimated that annually the Houthis take in less than $2 billion a year, and that's to control a population of roughly 25 million Yemenis. It's simply not sustainable. And so we are seeing the Houthis' failure to pay public sector salaries, failure to provide basic services, and on top of an extremely repressive system of governance, we were seeing growing dissent within Houthi-controlled parts of northern Yemen until October 7th. Following October 7th and these highly successful attacks that the Houthis have conducted, especially on maritime commerce, they've been able to reassert this narrative of themselves as the sole defenders of Yemen against external aggression. And because support for the Palestinian cause is quite strong across Yemen, this really bolstered their legitimacy inside of the country and distracted from their failures in governance. And then the third motivation is, as you mentioned, the Houthis' regional ambitions. As I mentioned previously, they do really see themselves as a major regional player. And these attacks have been a highly effective way to demonstrate that they can withstand military pressure from some of the most powerful militaries in the world, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel, and have an impact on global commerce. We've seen a fourfold increase in the costs of global container shipping. These are the containers that carry the commercial goods that, you and I depend on, and really disrupting maritime traffic in a major global waterway. So those consequences are, you know, far and above what we would expect from a group the size of the Houthis.
The Tel Aviv attack got everyone's attention. They flew a drone some 16 hours, more than 2,600 kilometers to reach Tel Aviv. I knew they were good and even innovative in the drone space. I've just read a report recently out by AQUID that goes in some detail about their drone capacities. It's downright scary. It's a bit like the Chinese using American technology back 20 years ago. They clearly have taken the Iranian technology and are developing really impressive, incredibly cheap, but effective technologies.
It's true. And I think they've really used roughly a decade of war to hone their capabilities. It's been a highly effective training ground for the Houthis, but also for the Iranians who have used the Houthis to kind of test out this new technology. So we're seeing, you know, very rapid advances in drone technology globally. Of course, you mentioned the July 19th attack, but I think it's also important to look at Houthi advancements with sea drones, with these unmanned surface and underwater vessels that successfully earlier this summer actually sank a ship. So this is new technology that could pose a significant threat to maritime traffic. And of course, we're seeing that currently with the Houthis, but I think it's, you know, this kind of asymmetric, rapidly evolving technology is something that we're going to have to cope with, not just with the Houthis, but with similar strategically placed malign actors who are going to increasingly be able to gain access to this technology, especially if we see the kind of growing coordination between the Houthis that we're hearing about with al-Shabaab, but also other members of Iran's axis of resistance. One thing that I am concerned about is the increase in coordinated attacks between the Houthis and other members of the axis of resistance of Iranian-backed groups. The Houthis announced in May that they were formally coordinating with Iraqi militia groups in their attacks, and they actually claimed a couple of joint attacks earlier this summer. One of the potential reasons that the Israelis failed to detect and detect and shoot down the Houthi drone on July 19th was that they were simultaneously battling a drone from Iraq. It's unclear if the July 19th attacks were coordinated, but I do think we're going to see an uptick in these kinds of coordinated attacks that are more difficult to defend against. And we could potentially even see that in response to the recent Iranian killings of both senior Hamas and Hezbollah commanders late July.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
I've seen reports of joint operation centers, not just between the Houthis and the Iranians, but all sorts of characters, the Iraqis, et cetera. I had not thought of the possibility that they, given their expertise and their experience, become another relay point to organizations that aren't as sophisticated as they have become, like al-Shabaab. But others around the region, both the immediate region and those tentacles, I go back to my octopus. I'm not sure who's the head of it or the brain of this thing anymore, but those tentacles. So Yemen, which I want to underline, is not just a dot on the map, but it's now becoming a player in a much larger and increasingly dangerous conflict.
No, I very much agree. And I think, you know, coordination between the Houthis and even just looking within Iranian-backed groups in the axis of resistance, because there is direct coordination between the Houthis and some of these groups, and including Shia militant groups in Iraq, it's creating a much faster proliferation of expertise and of technology, and potentially a much faster proliferation of chaos than Iran could have ever orchestrated itself if it were actually centrally managing all of these relationships and all of these operations. So I think it's another reason why it's important to kind of think beyond this pure proxy framing of the situation.
But stay with July 19th, just for one more question. Part of what was so spectacular was that after a whole series for months and months of American, UK, others battling with the Houthis over specific incidents, the Israelis responded dramatically. They attacked Hodeidah with a really impressive air assault that left the port burning for several days. In one sense, and I used this word earlier and it may be inappropriate, it does seem an exaggerated response given the what happened in Tel Aviv. But on the other hand, it clearly was, the Israelis clearly were responding to something much bigger than just that one attack on one apartment building. Is that your view?
That is my view. The Israelis said after their strikes on July 20th that the Houthis had conducted over 220 missile and drone attacks on Israeli territory since October 7th. Though most of these attacks either missed their targets or were shot down, they clearly were attempting to reestablish deterrence with the Houthis after these series of attacks. But Netanyahu, when he visited Washington, was also very clear that their view is that when they are combating the Houthis, they are combating Iran. So I think you're right to say that the Houthi or the Israeli response to the Houthi attacks was very much part of an attempt to signal to Iran and its partners in the region that they will respond very strongly to any continued attacks. That being said, I do not think the Israeli strikes were successful in reestablishing deterrence with the Houthis. Quite the opposite. The Iranian strikes gave something that to the Houthis that they've been seeking for years, which is direct conflict with Israel, with what many inside of Yemen seem to be as the ultimate foe. The Houthis' ideological beliefs, their slogan actually begins with "God is great, death to America, death to Israel, curse on all the Jews." So the opportunity for them to demonstrate that they are significant enough to enter in direct conflict with Israel is actually a great boon to their narrative inside of Yemen. And they will likely continue to attack Israel to help maintain this direct conflict with Israel, with the United States. And they calculate that any costs that they have to bear from those strikes are less significant than the political benefit that they gain from direct conflict with these actors. I will say that the Israeli strikes on Hodeidah were significant in terms of consequences, economic consequences for Yemen. Hodeidah is the main port serving northern Yemen, a main source of essential commercial goods for a country that imports roughly 90% of its food and other basic commodities. The strikes reportedly damaged 3/4 of northern Yemen's fuel storage capacity. Fuel, obviously, is essential to humanitarian response and to basic economic activity. The strikes also reportedly damaged some port infrastructure. So while we've seen continued operations at the port, the Houthis have attempted to reassure Yemenis that any impacts will be limited. I think we need to see how those consequences play out in terms of economic and humanitarian impact for Yemenis over the next several weeks.
Allison, I've got to say that as you were describing the response in Yemen to being attacked by the Israelis, all I could think of was Alice in Wonderland. Things really are upside down and backwards in the country and in the region, perhaps. Let's segue to possible solutions. In that same article that I mentioned earlier, you pointed out that the Houthis' attacks on shipping and the lack of a global response showed, quote, the difficulty of mobilizing a united front in the current geopolitical environment, even to address immediate threats to basic global goods, meaning international navigation and the movement of goods. That's a problem. Before we get to your optimism that something could be done, why has the Security Council de facto been AWOL on this?
It's a good question. And I think, you know, it's important to note that there has been a significant U.S. and to some degree EU response to the Houthi maritime attacks. The U.S. has mobilized Operation Prosperity Guardian that has shot down many of these attacks and actually launched left-of-launch defensive strikes against Houthi military assets to attempt to prevent future attacks against ships. And the Europeans have launched their own separate defensive capabilities to attempt to defend ships. One would hope that we could have seen an even stronger multilateral response to these maritime attacks because it has impacted every single member of the UN Security Council, including the permanent members of the Security Council. We've seen multiple Chinese and Russian-affiliated ships actually be striked by Houthi missiles and drones. The Chinese are suffering some of the most significant economic consequences from the disruption to global maritime commerce, precisely because the Red Sea and the Suez Canal is an essential conduit for trade between Europe and Asia. Despite facing these consequences, it appears that both the Russians and the Chinese calculate that the benefits that they gain in terms of the negative impacts the Houthi attacks have on U.S. credibility outweigh the costs that they are bearing economically as a result of the Houthi attacks. And for that reason, we have not seen the kind of really strong multilateral response to the attacks that we would have liked to see. There was, you know, some joint UN Security Council statements to this regard, but nothing that has been strong enough or effective enough to actually fully defend against the Houthi attacks or restore the confidence of maritime shippers. I think that since I wrote my article in April, the space for finding that kind of international UN Security Council unity has eroded even further. We saw in May the Houthis announce their fourth wave of escalation against Israel in response to Israeli operations in Rafah, which included a significant uptick in maritime attacks. And this coordination with other members of the Axis of Resistance that I've mentioned. We've also seen even further breakdown of that UN Security Council unity, most notably with reports of Russian cooperation, military cooperation with the Houthis in their maritime attacks. The Wall Street Journal reports that Russia was actually considering sending missiles to the Houthis to conduct these attacks, but was at least temporarily dissuaded by Saudi Arabia from doing so. And regional media reports are now also reporting that the Russians have sent military advisors to assist the Houthis in these attacks. This is an extremely concerning development. And even if the Russians are stopping short of providing direct military support to the Houthis, this kind of cooperation between Russia and the Houthis is going to be a major blow to any hope of UN Security Council unity on Yemen. I do think that any hope of restoring that unity is going to put a huge burden on the Saudis and the UAE. Those two countries have the most at stake when it comes to the Houthis and even when it comes to the maritime attacks, that we've seen them be relatively silent on the Houthi maritime attacks. But Saudi Arabia and the UAE are uniquely placed to secure Russian and Chinese cooperation with any sort of response to the Houthi threat. And they will have to bear a huge burden going forward if we're going to find any sort of solution to this challenge. The Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the current environment, their top priority has been to prevent renewed Houthi attacks on their territory again. These Houthi attacks have been paused since the April 2022 truce. And if the Houthis were to renew attacks on Saudi Arabia and UAE in the current environment, it could be extremely dangerous, really opening up that new front in the regional war that everyone is so scared of right at this moment. That being said, this gives the Houthis significant leverage over the Saudis, over the Emiratis, to continue to extract major concessions from the group. Potentially, if we were to reach a Gaza ceasefire, it might give the Saudis and the Emiratis greater political space. But I think as long as the Houthis hold that leverage over the Gulf countries, they're going to be negotiating at the barrel of a gun, and it's going to be very difficult to place any sort of guardrails on Houthi behavior that would be necessary to address the sustained Houthi threat to regional stability and to maritime commerce. Ultimately, the solution to this challenge is going to come from addressing the Houthi incentives, the Houthi motivations for the attacks. For some time, the path for doing this has been the UN-led peace process, and specifically a roadmap that the UN Special Envoy to Yemen developed between the Yemeni parties that would get them on track for a formal ceasefire, a political process, and a series of economic measures. The future of that roadmap in the current environment is frankly uncertain, but in order to get it back on track, to renew a political process, there has to be, first and foremost, stronger UN Security Council and regional unity on what those guardrails on Houthi behavior need to be. And there needs to be a willingness from those countries to actually uphold those red lines, to uphold those guardrails when it comes down to it.
One of the problems with that, obviously, and you know it better than I, is that Yemen, even the Red Sea, doesn't sit in isolation, but exactly because of the great power relationships you've been describing, sits in a much larger context, which includes the Ukraine war, includes South China Sea, includes all sorts of issues, where the great powers, the U.S., China, Russia, Europe, with maybe quotes around Europe, because I don't know what Europe is anymore, clearly do not have a shared vision, clearly are not articulating shared problems and looking for shared solutions in almost any space. I would conclude that this is unlikely to be the place where it would start, although God knows it would be a good place to start. Can we leave our listeners with anything more optimistic than my conclusion, which is batten the hatches? And it's unfair. I apologize for asking you to pull a Wizard of Oz here.
No, it's a fair question. Unfortunately, I think there's not a lot of space for optimism now, but. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that the Houthis are very likely here to stay. Absent some sort of major ground offensive that pushes the Houthis out of northern Yemen, that no one in the region or internationally seems to have any appetite for, we're going to be dealing with the Houthis for the next few decades. The question is, can we moderate Houthi behavior? Can we take steps to address their extremely high risk tolerance and aggressive posture? And I would say in the current environment, it is very difficult. And it is very difficult in part because of the posture of regional actors like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The one hope comes from if we can get to a Gaza ceasefire. I want to be very clear that I see a Gaza ceasefire as a necessary but not a sufficient step to addressing the Houthi threat. I think that there are some observers and unfortunately some policymakers who hope that the Houthi threat will simply disappear after we get a Gaza ceasefire. But because the Houthi motivations for these maritime attacks go beyond just the crisis in Gaza, and because any sort of path to sustainable peace in Gaza is going to be a very rocky one, I think we can expect the Houthi threat to maritime shipping in particular to continue for the foreseeable future. But if we can get to a Gaza ceasefire, it will open up greater political space. And that's the moment in which we need to see much stronger leadership from Saudi Arabia, from UAE, try to chart a path forward.
If the Houthis won their war in Yemen, or to be more precise, captured Marib and the oil fields so they have revenues, would it be naive to hope that they might begin to normalize, or would they become North Korea?
So One of the complications for the Houthis gaining access to hydrocarbon revenues is the fact that the most lucrative hydrocarbon revenues in Yemen are actually their natural gas resources. And natural gas production has been paused since the war in Yemen broke out in 2015. In order to restart production, they would need to transport the natural gas from the Ma'arib province in northern Yemen all the way to the export terminal in southern Yemen, the kind of heartland of southern Yemen, where opposition to the Houthis is extremely strong. And it will be very difficult for the Houthis at their current level of strength to capture and control that territory. On top of that, to restart production and export, the Houthis would need to gain the confidence of the private sector shareholders from that now control the Yemen natural gas project. So I find it very difficult to imagine the Houthis restoring private sector confidence in an environment when they're still blowing up ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, precisely where these exports would be occurring. So, you know, this is the Houthis' lack of economic resources are a major source of vulnerability for the group, is a major vulnerability to their long-term viability, and do present a potential pathway towards some sort of solution that moderates their behavior, even if they continue to play a major role in Yemen going forward.
Allison Miner, thank you very much for this conversation. Let's leave it there. We're way down in the rabbit hole, and it's looking pretty grim down here. So let's leave it there and come back and revisit, hopefully when there's movement in some more positive direction. So again, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.